Hello, this is Kathy Hart, host of the Health First Radio Show. Today we have some wonderful guests on for you. In the first half, we're going to talk to Terry Matthews, executive producer of On the Spectrum. She's a mother, CEO, and founder of Jaden's Garden for Autism. And then in the second half, we're going to have author Thelma Rees, and she's going to be talking about the new senior man. But first, here's Alan with the Health First News.
Many emergency room doctors underestimate how often they prescribe potentially addictive opioid painkillers, new research shows. But they pare back those pills when they see their real numbers, according to the University of Colorado study. Of 109 ER doctors at four hospitals, two-thirds underestimated how often they prescribed opioids such as OxyContin and Vicodin, the researchers said. As health experts struggled to understand the underpinnings of the U.S. opioid epidemic, they found that legally prescribed pills got many addicts initially hooked. During the 12-month study, the ER doctors wrote 15,124 prescriptions for opioids. This represented about 20% of all their prescribing. The study was published in the March issue of the journal Academic Emergency Medicine. Hay fever sufferers often choose the wrong medication for their seasonal sniffles, new research suggests. With flowers, trees, and grasses springing back to life, folks with allergies will start to complain of sneezing, runny noses, and watery, itchy eyes. More often than not, though, they'll head to the allergy aisle of their nearest drugstore without advice from a doctor or pharmacist, the new study found. Only 63% of people who visit their community pharmacy to purchase treatment for their hay fever have a doctor diagnosis, said study senior author Cynthia Bosnick-Antesevich. Moreover, 70% select their own hay fever medication without consulting the pharmacist, and of those who reported wheezing, only 6% chose the correct medication, the study found. The results were published March 29th in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology, In Practice. Despite recommendations, only about 1 in 10 U.S. baby boomers has been screened for hepatitis C virus, a new study reveals. Hepatitis C is a contagious virus that causes nearly half of the cases of liver cancer in the United States. Health officials estimate that about 1 in 30 Americans born between 1945 and 1965, the baby boomer generation, has chronic HCV infection, but most don't know it. Study lead author Monica Kasting said hepatitis C is an interesting virus because people who develop a chronic infection remain asymptomatic for decades and don't know they're infected. She is a postdoctoral fellow at Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida. The study findings were published in the March 27th issue of Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers, and Prevention. A smoke is a smoke is a smoke. New research suggests that folks who smoke pot may be more prone to taking up or returning to the cigarette habit. One tobacco cessation expert said the findings aren't surprising. Patricia Foland, who directs Northwell Health Center for Tobacco Control in Great Neck, New York, said among individuals she has treated, the majority of those who smoke cannabis as well as cigarettes often have a more difficult time quitting, do not want to give up their cannabis use, and are more likely to relapse to cigarette smoking. The new research was led by Renee Goodwin of Columbia University School of Public Health in New York City. Her team tracked data on nearly 35,000 American adults who took part in a national survey. The study was published online recently in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry.
Okay, so we haven't had Terry Matthews call in yet, and so we're going to play a rerun, a Burnout into Brilliance with Denise Green. Here she is. Denise Green is a speaker, a writer, and executive coach dedicated to helping people ignite their potential and go from burnout or blah to brilliant. After a successful career in corporate, Denise founded Brilliance Incorporated, a coaching and training corporation. For over a decade, she and her team have helped thousands of people feel less stressed and have more ease and fulfillment in all areas of their life. She knows what it's like to overcome major setbacks. After a car accident in 2003, she was told by a doctor that she might never be able to work. Denise has been referred to as a mini Tony Robbins because of her humor, compassion, knowledge, and pragmatism she brings to helping people to transform their lives. And we're so fortunate to have you on the show today. Welcome, Denise.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. This is such an important topic that's close to my heart.
So where do we start with the, if we've got blah and burnout, where are we going to start to bring this into brilliance?
Well, you start where you are, to borrow a famous phrase from Pema Chodron. Not everybody's in burnout, and a lot of my clients would never say they're in burnout. They would probably say they're stressed out, but if you don't deal with stress, you will burn out, and you will break in some form or fashion. Your health will suffer. it's going to suffer regardless of the level of stress you're feeling. But we all know that if we don't take control of it and get the upper hand, that we will break. So I just like to reach my clients, and my hope with this book was to reach people before they break, or if they have broken, to give them steps to come back.
Okay. And it's a program of really realigning your thoughts.
That is the most important step. So my brilliance model contains four different aspects, and the first has to do with the brain and the mind. And you can't master any of the other realms, which one of them is about the body and behavior, one of them is about your relationships to people, and one of them is about your relationships to stuff. But let's say you make a temporary fix, like we've all done this, where we've made a temporary fix and lost weight, for example, or we made a temporary fix and cleaned out our garage. And then if we don't manage the thoughts that cause us to build up stress, to overeat, to collect too many things from the beginning, if we don't manage our thoughts, then all of that is going to backtrack, and we're going to find ourselves thinking, why can't I do this? Why aren't I able to sustain these improvements that I've made? And it's because you didn't manage your thoughts.
And what way can we get past these self-sabotaging thoughts and behaviors and change them out?
Right. The first thing you have to do is notice that you're having thoughts. I know that sounds kind of dumb, but we have something like 60,000 thoughts a day. And most of them are completely useless because our brains are programmed to keep us alive, to keep us safe, and we never have enough information. So just in case there's a saber-toothed tiger going to come and attack you, just in case, your brain is going to go to worst-case scenario. So that email you got from your coworker that didn't say hi and have a smiley face emoticon, you're going to assume that person's mad at you, even though there's no evidence of that. That's what our brain does, and then we go and make a snarky comment or reply back with a snarky email back to that person that was unfounded. So the first thing you have to do is notice that your thoughts are not real. They are stories your brain makes up to make sense of the world and to keep you safe. So once you start to notice your thoughts, then you can start to question them and say, what is my evidence for this? How is this thought making me feel? And what is that emotion prompting me to do? For example, if I'm overwhelmed, then I go to the drawer and I have a piece of chocolate, and then I have another piece of chocolate, and then I have another piece of chocolate. Where is that leading to? Why am I doing that? What's the emotion that thought created in me that I wanted to try and cover up and mask with chocolate?
So it's becoming the observer of your own mind and your own thoughts.
Exactly. And then you decide, what would I like to think instead? And some of my clients, they have a hard time with that one. Like, what do you mean, what do I want to think instead? So sometimes I ask them, okay, what is that thought making you feel? And they'll say resentment, anger, whatever it may be. And then we could use the example of traffic. You know, that person who cuts you off. Okay, you had the thought, rude, how rude. I can't believe that person did that. How dare she? Okay, that was the thought you had. What was the emotion you had? Well, that was really angry, all right? What would you rather feel instead of anger as you're driving to work? Because, you know, is anger really serving you? And they might say, well, I'd rather feel...
compassion. Oh.
I'd rather feel compassion. Yeah, it could be anything. Yeah. They just got to find an emotion that actually then feels better in their body, and then they can backtrack and say, what would you need to think in order to feel compassion?
Okay. So it would be partly getting out of a victim mindset that people are always trying to do something to you.
Absolutely. And it's really hard to notice that we're in victim mindset because your brain doesn't want you to notice, because the brain wants you to just sit in victim mindset. It is the easiest place to go. It requires zero energy, because when you live in victim mindset, you don't have to change anything. You can just sit there and wish that other people would change and then resent them for not changing. But you don't have to do anything. So that's what your brain would like you to do. So I try not to begrudge people who go into victim mindset. I mean, after my car accident, I lived in victim mindset. I set up a nice little camp there for the better part of a year. And because everything that was going on was so all-consuming and overwhelming to me that that's where I went. And we go there all the time, every day, and it's not your fault. It's your brain. It's your brain's programming. So it's a good thing to notice, here I am in victim mindset. How can I shift to something that's within my control? And even though it feels scary to take ownership of things, it feels a heck of a lot better to feel in control of your circumstances rather than victimhood.
Mm-hmm. Give us some tools, Denise. How do we switch over?
Well, the first thing is, if you're noticing that you're feeling resentment, then you might want to conjure up that quote from Mandela that said, resentment is like drinking poison and expecting that it will kill your enemies.
Mm-hmm.
So notice that you are there, and then you can go back and shift to compassion, and shift to how might that person be suffering, that person I'm judging, how might they be suffering?
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're, we have the wildfires going on right now, 40 miles from where I'm living in California, and it's out of control. It's a tragedy, and people's homes are burning down. And who would blame them for going into victimhood? But the people who will thrive the most are the ones that accept what has happened, because why do anything other than accept what has happened? You cannot change what has happened. So you're fighting against reality if you don't accept what has happened. That doesn't mean you have to like what has happened, but you accept it and then say, what is within my span of control? What can I take ownership of right now and do? And it might be a small thing, but there's always something you can do, even if it's only to take control of your thoughts. And we're seeing some really beautiful, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little emotional here, but
that's okay.
You know, it's those people where you see on the news and they're just so grateful for their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And they're so grateful for the neighbor that picked them up on the street that they didn't even know and saved them and their dog. And they're so grateful to be alive. And it's that. There's always something.
So it's that attitude of gratitude to just to catch it all the time. What could I be grateful for in any situation?
In any situation. And this is not Pollyanna. This is survival. If you live in victimhood, if you can't find something that's within your control, and you're always complaining about the things that are outside your control, whether it's your boss, your health, the weather, if you constantly are complaining about that, you're going to make yourself sick, mm-hmm. and you'll never reach your potential, because we can't reach our potential from victimhood. We have to take charge. So this is life or death. We're all dying. So let's live the best life we can, and we have to do it by taking control over little things. So that's why sometimes we say, if you're feeling overwhelmed, clean out a junk drawer, because it gives you that sense of control. If you're feeling overwhelmed, you're trying to do too many things at once, and you can only do one thing at a time. So stop, take a breath, and ask yourself, what would be the best use of my time right now?
And do we let go of any other should do's in our life? Like, do we just back up out of any of those toxic should do's?
Oh my gosh. I don't know if you've read that part of my book, but I love taking my my clients and my workshop participants through the should do exercise. And I just have them brainstorm for 30 seconds, not longer than that, because I just think it's such a horrific exercise. But just brainstorm all the things they tell themselves they should do. And I'm sure you and I could come up with a list for ourselves right now. But should do's don't get done. They only make us feel guilty and pathetic and weak. And what I have them do is then take my 6-minute life satisfaction assessment, and they really hone in on one thing in their life that is out of sync and that they are ready to take on right now. They don't have to know how, but they're ready to take it on right now. Then I have them go back to that crummy should-do list, see if it's on there. It always is. Circle that one and cross off everything else, because otherwise, you're going to drag that stuff around, those should-dos. You're going to drag them around like a ball and chain. They're going to weigh you down, and they're not going to motivate you. They're only going to weigh you down with guilt.
Mm-hmm. So it leaves a sense of lightness to be really focused on what you really need to do for the day rather than having the weight of everything that you should do for months packing up on you.
Absolutely. And we judge ourselves so poorly. We have five times as many thought processes for negative thinking as positive mm-hmm. thinking. So a lot of those should-dos are things based on what society tells us we should do, what commercials and magazines tell us we should do, what our parents told us we should be doing with our lives, but they're not really our truth. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example. And sometimes they are our truth, but we're not ready for it. So as an example, I had on my should-do list for years that I should write a book, and I felt very guilty and pathetic for not doing it. And then I did this exercise, and one day it just dawned on me. I'm crazy to think I can write a book right now. I mean, I was getting a divorce. I was moving. I had Lyme disease. I had mold poisoning. I was sick. I was trying to transition my daughter into kindergarten during this very difficult time. And I thought, why am I putting all this pressure on myself about something that I clearly need to have a lot of capacity to do? And so I demoted it, and immediately I felt so much better. And when you demote it, you're not saying, I'm never going to do this. You're saying,
it's
now
the
is
list
not
for the
time.
Week.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Denise, we have to go to a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue to talk about all these steps from turning burnout into brilliance.